Podo. You're listening to The Election Tricycle with Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat.
Welcome to The Election Tricycle, a podcast where we track elections in the UK, the US and in India, and sometimes in other parts of the world as well. This week we have again Tom Hamilton from London and Emily Tamkin, who's returned from holiday and back on the podcast.
That's right. I'm back in a big way.
Just before we get going, I'd like to remind folks that the Election Tricycle has a premium segment. We do extra goodies for those who'd like to support our work and want to get more discussion on elections around the world. All you have to do to subscribe to our extra bits is go to tricycle.hubwave.net, where we often do portrait profiles of characters from our respective elections, discuss reader questions, and also occasionally a funny or interesting vignette from one of our countries or beyond. That's tricycle.hubwave.net. This week, before we get into our main segment, we thought we'd have a quick catch-up on what happened in Slovakia, where there were presidential elections that we discussed a couple of weeks ago. Emily, what happened?
That's right. So if you listened to this podcast a couple or a few weeks ago, you'll remember that we discussed presidential elections in Slovakia. Now, the reason that these elections were so important, even though the president in Slovakia is largely a symbolic figure, is that sort of populist, I would say aspiring authoritarian, allegedly corrupt, current government of Slovakia, which returned to power after 2023's elections. Prior to this, the current president or the outgoing president, Zuzana Čaputova, had been somewhat of a check on him, right? Had managed to force certain judicial reforms that he wanted to make through the courts and block them, had blocked certain cabinet appointments. And so it was thought that if the opposition figure or the figure aligned with the opposition had won, at least there would continue to be some check in Slovakia on the prime minister, Robert Fica, and his government. That is what happened in the first round. But when the runoff round was this past weekend, and Peter Pellegrini, who is the sometime Fica ally, won. So it's not certain that he'll just be a rubber stamp on everything that Fica does. But I think I'm sort of a cynic about this. I think it's probably likely. And that this was one election this year that is sort of sad news for those who want rule of law and accountability and anti-corruption efforts to pull through in elections. But now back to our regularly scheduled Tricycle programming. Tom?
Yeah, so we thought that what we'd do this week is talk a bit about what is a really regular theme in basically almost any election that you've ever heard of anywhere in the world, which is the theme of whether an election is a change election or a continuity election, whether this country needs change message, which is a conventional opposition message, or the we need more of the same, help us finish the job message, which is normally an incumbent government message, how those are playing in our three systems in the same ways and in different ways. And I think I'm going to start off by talking about how that's playing in the UK, and then we'll think about how it's going in India and the States in, I'm not quite sure which order, we'll see how the conversation goes. But it's really interesting in Britain, where we have obviously a government that's been in office for 14 years now, albeit with a surprisingly large number of prime ministers over that time. We're on prime minister at number, I think, 5 since David Cameron, who was a relatively long-serving prime minister, about six years in office. But then all the other ones have been a lot shorter, including Liz Truss, who we've spent almost as long speaking about on this podcast as she had in office in total as prime minister, including the time she spent asleep, who did 49 days, and then Rishi Sunak's been in office ever since then. Which means that a continuity message is quite hard for that party to run, just because there just hasn't been a lot of continuity, especially over the sort of the second half of this of the Tories' time in office. And one of the really interesting things about the way that Rishi Sunak has approached his time as prime minister is a real confusion about whether he wants to be a changed prime minister or a more of the same prime minister. And he's ended up being a bit of both at different times in ways that are really quite confusing if you stop and think about it. So one of the things that he did at his conference speech last year, when he'd been in office for a bit less than a year. The big theme of his conference speech was that there'd been a failed consensus in UK politics ever since the fall of Margaret Thatcher, basically sort of 30 years ago, and that we needed to break out from this failed consensus, which politicians of both main parties had been responsible for over that period, and we needed to do new things. And you know, that includes quite serious criticism of some conservative politicians as well as of Labour ones you'd expect Rishi Sunak to be attacking, but none of it was by name. He wasn't prepared to say quite who was responsible for all this, but implicitly it was, you know, especially David Cameron in that period as the sort of, and George Osborne as the architects of the first phase of this Tory government. And the main thing he did in this sort of change speech was to say that he was going to stop a major public project that had been going on for some time, HS2, which is a high-speed rail line from the south of England to the north of England, and he was going to basically curtail it from where it was planned to go. So this is sort of a big change, albeit arguably not a very sensible one for the purposes of national infrastructure. Anyway, the speech didn't go down very well, and within about a month of making his speech, he'd appointed David Cameron, who he'd criticised not quite by name, as the foreign secretary in his government on the grounds that he was a highly experienced and effective minister, which, to be fair, he is one of the most effective ministers in the Sunak government. He was actually in the States, and he may still be in the States now, trying to persuade various different politicians across the spectrum in America to back more aid to Ukraine. But immediately leaving that continuity message behind. But at the same time, his core message that he gives the public is that we need to stick to the plan that's working. He's got a plan, we've got to stick to it. So that's very much a continuity message. And yet at the same time, on top of that, the big forward-looking policy that he's got is that he wants to abolish a particular tax in the UK, national insurance. It's one of the taxes that you pay on your income if you're working in the UK. And then in the long term, he wants to see that got rid of, which, whether you think it's a good idea or a bad idea from a public policy point of view, is a really major change in the way that we're taxed, and it will only happen if the Tories win the election. And so one of their messages is, if you want to end this, then you've got to vote for us. And so it's really hard to know where we are on change versus more of the same. Now, so far as the opposition is concerned, you'd expect them to be running a it's time for change message, and you know, they are. Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, obviously wants to have a change of government, and a lot of his messaging is about how the Tories have made a mess of things over the last 14 years and that we need change. And one of his big sort of validation messages about why we can trust him to change the country is that he's changed his party from the party that was led by Jeremy Corbyn 4 or 5 years ago, which had quite a different approach from the party now. And again, whatever you think of Jeremy Corbyn or Keir Starmer, that is broadly true, and there has been quite a significant change in the way the Labour Party's been run, which is one of the reasons, not the only reason, but it is one of the reasons why Labour is doing a lot better in the polls than it was when Corbyn was in charge. But at the same time, one of the main criticisms that Starmer gets from the left in particular is that he's not offering a change, that he's too similar to the Tories, that he's too cautious, that there are loads of areas where the country needs reform of various kinds, where it needs additional public spending to deal with failing public services. And you know, these are all quite reasonable arguments about the state of public service in the UK, and that he's not promising that, and that he's offering continuity when we need change. He's too cautious. And his strategic caution and Rachel Reeves's caution over spending is conscious. It's a dividing line that they are offering up. They are saying the Tories have made a mess of the economy, especially over the last sort of relatively short period when, you know, Liz Truss spent an enormous amount of money on tax cuts and then almost immediately reversed them, and everyone's mortgages and rents went up and it was economically pretty catastrophic. He wants to say, I'm not going to do that sort of thing. I know some people would like me to spend more money and raise more taxes, but we can't do that because it isn't safe economically to do that. We've got to be careful about how we spend money, which is not a mad message, but it's also not a very exciting message. So that's a dividing line in itself. And of course, the fact that the Tories want to cut this major tax going forward, but haven't said quite yet what their timetable is for doing it, how they'd pay for doing it. There are all sorts of different ways you could do it, some of them more sensible than others, but they just haven't said what their method is. That is another dividing line, that, you know, we've got this forward-looking, speculative economic instability from the Tories, maybe if they win, versus a more economically cautious approach from Labour, while at the same time, in lots of ways, wanting to be quite radical. So it is a change versus more of the same election, because all elections always are, but it's one in which both parties are trying to embody both change and more of the same at the same time in ways that get quite confusing. And I don't know whether in either of the two other elections that we focus on in this podcast, whether it's any clearer. In America, it seems to me to be a bit more straightforwardly, you know, Trump wants to rip everything up and Biden doesn't.
Well, I mean, no, I think we also have similarly crisscrossing lines here because, all right, let's start with Biden. You know, in 2020, it was Build Back Better. So it was both the promise of sort of going back to pre-COVID and also pre-Trump, but also promising change. So the sense of both restoration, but also improvement. This time, Biden is the incumbent and he sort of is running on, and I think this is a problem. I think similarly to Starmer, some Democrats, especially on the left, would say this is a problem, that even though he actually has done more than I think many expected of him domestically, he's really just saying, vote for me because the alternative is Trump. Like that is the overriding theme or one overriding theme of this campaign. I mean, he said, like, I'm running against this guy called Donald Trump. So that's, in a way, that's the incumbent of promising more of the same, you know, and touting his record and so on and so forth. But basically saying, like, the change that will be brought is so horrific to even imagine that please don't vote for it. The Republican Party right now, I think, is really interesting, parenthetical, derogatory, in how they balance this, because to some extent, the Trump campaign is trying to play this trick where they like convince you that Biden was president in 2020, which was a horrific year, which he was not. But also more than that, I think the whole MAGA movement is both promising like dramatic change, right, to the civil service, to foreign policy, to life as we know it. But it's also in this language of more of the same from before, like from many decades ago. It's this like nativist returning America to, you know, we used to be, you know, the country's gone to hell. So it's both change and also fighting back against change and the fear that some in our society feel at the idea of change. I think they both straddle these lines.
It's make America great again. The
right,
word again is critical in that,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. Yes.
I mean, what's most interesting to me about what Tom's talking about is this effort from a long incumbent party in the UK in attempting to portray itself as the change party to some extent without a fundamental rupture. You know, if Trump had followed a, let's say, a Republican presidency, you could still argue he was something of a rupture from the establishment. And so I know people disagree with certain elements of that, but, you know, there are candidates even within the Tories maybe who could make more forcefully that argument, and Rishi Sunak is not that person. In India, it plays out in an interesting way. So, of course, last week we spoke of, and this was on the premium segment. So for those who you know, aren't premium subscribers, do know that we're having lots more discussions in the additional extra bits. We discussed Kachativu, which is this island that India recognized as being part of Sri Lanka in the 70s, that has come up as an issue now in Indian politics, because the BJP-led central government needs to find an issue to take on and to appear to be fighting some opponent when everyone thinks they will win. And so they're going back, as often Modi has done, to Nehru and saying that Nehru and Indira Gandhi before were the villains of the peace, and we'll make sure you don't return to that. But one of the unappreciated things of Indian elections, which does the same thing in a very different way, is the BJP is running again, as we've talked about quite a bit, and is expected to win. And, you know, they're clear front runners. There's little question about this. And yet, out of the 303 BJP MPs who won last time, a whole 100 of them have been dropped. And so you're going into these elections with an assumed continuity, because it's Modi at the top and it's the BJP. But 1/3 of that parliamentary class has been dropped as candidates.
Why is that, Rohan? Because we had a situation in the UK before the 2019 election where Boris Johnson basically kicked quite a significant number of largely pro-Remain Tory MPs out of the Tory party. And so there was more of a renewal of the personnel within the Tory parliamentary party than would otherwise have been. Is there a single reason why most of these people have been kicked out, or is it 100 different reasons for 100 different people?
It's a good question. One of the answers is that it's not uncommon in India, especially in places where sort of where you can see party loyalty over candidate loyalty. But it's one of those classic ways of addressing anti-incumbency is to say that we'll change the local level leader while having continuity at the top. It's been done before, but you're seeing Modi and the current BJP do it in a way that at a much larger scale, because they can offer so much continuity and stability at the top that they can change. I mean, in both Haryana, a state in the north, and Gujarat, Modi's home state, in the last couple of years, they've not only just changed a large number of the candidates running again, they've changed the chief ministers without there being a big reason to do so. Just ahead of elections, keeping the idea that as they become so to speak, a hegemonic party where they, you know, you can expect them to just continue winning. They've controlled Gujarat for two decades now. They have to offer the public change in some form, and they do it within the party without, you know, letting the opposition have a leg in, you know. And it's really interesting because I don't know about with the UK and Boris Johnson, but what number it was. But yeah, I think people outside India are often surprised that the incumbent that's front runner is dropping a third of its candidates and is able to do that without significant rebellion, without, you know, seeing it lose its support as a result of that.
I do think we have sort of a similar dynamic here, although it's less managed from the top, so to say, which is that there's this change versus incumbency between the parties, but also within the parties. You see this a little bit in the Democratic Party because you have with the Squad and progressives and the discussions around Joe Biden's age, which, by the way, have sort of receded for the moment in America's political discourse. It was like he did an okay job at the State of the Union, and then the actual transcript from his deposition came out and everyone was like, oh, that's fine. And we sort of moved it along. But anyway, but conversations around his age, but you really see it in the Republican Party. These Republicans who are of the mold of what we want in our pre-Trump world, like associated with a classic Republican, they're leaving. They're just like, I can't do it anymore. Like, if you occasionally shake hands with a Democrat, you're run out of town. And I think those promising change within the Republican Party are like, no, it's Trump's party now and Trump allies party now. And I think they're right, honestly. Right? Like, I don't think it's Mitch McConnell's party. It's Donald Trump's party.
Just because Trump is exerting quite a lot of pressure on Congress just by saying, this is how you should vote. If you don't vote the way that I say, then there's going to be trouble. I mean, it's hard to stand to.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I think two great examples are the border and Ukraine and funding for Ukraine. If Trump had not said, like, no, don't make a deal. The deal that was before Congress on the border was like a draconian piece of legislation, in my opinion. You know, this is not like a pro-immigrant, sure. Pro-migration bill, and he said, don't vote for it. And they didn't, because he said, right, because it's about, like, it was about, no, we want this to be a problem for the election, and we want Trump to be back in power, and we want our guys to be the ones fixing this. I know that there are Republicans in Congress who grew up, like, worshiping Ronald Reagan, you know, telling themselves that America won the Cold War, who, in a slightly different situation, would never be voting to hold up aid to Ukraine. But they are. Because these issues now matter less than what Trump tells them to do.
And America has, because it's broadly a two-party system, it's set up to allow for these through the primaries, like in a way that at least doesn't happen in India, right? Like where you're given a safe space, so to speak, to challenge your own party man.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I think is, in some ways, is good. Parties should be accountable to their voters. And yeah, why should the people who have always been at the top continue to be at the top? Except that when there's a takeover of one of our two major parties, there's really no mechanism to like break the coalition, or, you know, you can't just say like, oh, I'm no longer going to be the minority partner in the government now and bring it down, because you're still stuck in the same party as them.
But that's partly because of fear of the voters in their own electoral base.
Yeah, I guess. Okay. I think a way of putting this is that right now Republicans are acting as though we're in a parliamentary system. And actually, we're in a presidential system. And I think fear has a huge role to play in that. And I have to say that this is sort of a tangent, but there are Republicans or Republican operatives, or, you know, who have said, like, we're afraid, we get death threats. And I sympathize with that, of course, but Democrats are also getting death threats, right? It's not like AOC or Ilhan Omar are just like waltzing into their offices every day, no problem, not worried about their safety and security. So I think perhaps for the health of the nation, that's something that we should grapple with, but I'm not an elected Republican.
Yeah, but some of the Democrats, they are absolutely facing the same threats of violence, arguably from different people, but the same threats of violence that some of these Republicans are, but they're not facing the same sort of grassroots primary challenges, I think. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's, well, I mean, they are being primaried, but from the center.
Yeah. I mean, in one sense, everyone gets primaried, right?
Yeah. So it's not really comparable. And you know what, to a certain extent, so for example, I am a strong believer that Mitch McConnell, after Trump was impeached the second time, should have whipped his senators to vote to convict. And Trump would have not been the leader of the party anymore in a certain sense, because he would no longer have been able to hold elected office. There are people who, when I make this point, will say, but they would have been primaried and lost their primaries. And like, they're not wrong. Personally, I think that's a choice that they should have made, because the thing that you're saving in addition to the country is the Republican Party and sort of taking back control, as they say, from this one guy, but they would have been primaried and they would likely have lost.
Maybe one question, I don't know if we need to open up that, is for the change in continuity question, is how Trump has laid out this week on abortion.
Before you answer that as well, Emily, I think one of the things that really interested me about that is the way that Biden is using that as a change message. If you don't elect me, we're not going to be able to get Roe versus Wade back. And, you know, quite whether he can achieve that even if he wins, I think feels to me like it's probably up for grabs. But he's certainly right that it won't happen if he loses.
This is an issue that has gone from Democrats for being a continuity issue to a change issue. And in some ways for Republicans, the exact reverse has happened. And I think they found that it's actually easier to run on this when it's a change issue.
Like Brexit.
Like, yeah, absolutely. Like abortion and Brexit. I am always drawing a comparison between those two. I think you're absolutely right, Rohan, that Trump is trying to play both sides on this, to say like, oh, it will still be up to the states. But also I'm the guy who got rid of Roe versus Wade. Side note, I think everyone should disabuse themselves of the notion that if a national abortion ban came before him, he wouldn't sign it. Like saying, oh, well, this is the law of the land, is it's kind of cutesy thing that Republicans have done for a long time. We've seen where that's ended. And I think, I think Biden for a long time was a little too continuity on this issue. I'll say that, right? A little too. I personally think that he was too conservative and still is in many ways on the matter of reproductive rights. But I do think in this election, he has at least realized for his own political survival, like you need to couch this in terms of change, right? You need to couch this in terms of both what you can do to ameliorate the situation and also to make clear that Republicans, even though they're saying, like some are saying, oh, it'll still be up to the states, it's really continuity, that things will get worse for those seeking to have bodily autonomy.
So I guess what we can say to wrap the whole thing up is that all three of our elections are going to be won by the Continuity Party and by the Change Party.
Yes.
Because those are the only options on the ballot, whoever wins.
Yeah, and that we've seen that these candidates want to be both, depending on their audience.
Well, I think that about wraps it up for our main section today. Thanks a lot for listening. And we will be back in a minute for those of you who have signed up for our premium section. If you haven't, please do on tricycle.hubwave.net. For those of you that haven't, go away, come back next week. And for those of you that have, see you in just a second.
The Election Tricycle is a Poddo podcast hosted by Tom Hamilton, Emily Tamkin and Rohan Venkat. It is series produced by Nick Hilton. Tweet us at Tricycle2024 and watch a video version of the show at cooler.news. For sales and advertising, please email nick@podopods.com. podopods.com.